Amy Rowan, ABS, CSC, is a board-certified sexologist by the American Board of Sexologists, a professional member of the Association of Somatic and Integrative Sexologists, a member of the World Association of Sexual Health, and the World Association of Sex Coaches. We must have a massive business card. Hold on. Amy has been blissfully married to her husband James for 20 years. She's also a sports mom, driving a minivan through the burbs, trying to get her kids to where she needs to get to. I know that story. She has three sons in middle and high school. Amy is a breast cancer survivor. She loves to play tennis, is obsessed with vinegar and fostering kittens. Amy is the person you can trust to help with topics no one talks about. Amy is a co-host of the Sensational Sex Podcast and host of the wildly successful Unlocking Intimacy and Unlock Your Sexual Pleasure Summits. There's a lot there. The first thing I have to ask, actually, because my wife has almost an obsessive hatred of vinegar. What's the story with vinegar? Why do you like vinegar?
Oh my gosh. It started when I was in elementary school and, you know, we would have lunch served and there was always this Italian dressing, just basic Italian dressing on the table. And I could not get enough of it. I don't know, you know, I'm like 6 years old, like eating salad. Yeah. And it's not because I was, you know, watching my figure at that point. And I also had an obsession with A1 sauce. And at some point I connected the dots and realized that it was an obsession with vinegar, which has then turned into an obsession with gourmet vinegars and things like that. But I literally crave vinegar on a regular basis. I think it's strange. I don't know, but I get vinegar for, you know, Mother's Day and my birthday. And I'm very happy with it.
my wife would think it was very strange. She's okay with buff and vinegar, but anything sort of like we have fish and chip shops here, so like chip shop, the vinegar you have in your chips. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
No, just that. I love it, but just that. I used to have sandwiches when I was a kid, and I would soak them in vinegar and then put the topping on. That's kind of weird. just going back to your formative years, so maybe a bit later than sort of six, but when you were in your teens or late teens, did you feel very comfortable with your sexuality and intimacy? Did you recognize the person you'd become today?
The interesting thing about my upbringing specifically is that I'm the daughter of an OBGYN and a psychologist. And okay. So I think that explains a lot about how I ended up where I ended up. And so, you know, going back to middle school, my friends were asking me questions that they either didn't feel comfortable asking their own parents, or they didn't feel, you know, or they hadn't seen a doctor. And so I would ask my dad those same questions and then report back. And through that sort of being the intermediary process, you know, learn a lot. And so talking about, you know, body parts, talking about vaginas, talking about sex and intimacy, I think all of that was very comfortable for me. Also, just from overhearing my dad's conversations, you know, during our dinner time with patients and things like that. So would teenage Amy be surprised by what I'm doing now? I don't think she would. I don't think she would, because it just seems like a natural progression. And I feel like it's the gift that I have to offer, you know, the world and people who need help, because it is so challenging for so many people to talk about it.
Oh, it is. It really is. And when you were beginning to explore your own sexuality, both with yourself and then with partners, were you always very curious, sort of first one in the class to do this or to explore that or to talk about it?
I think I was very curious. But what I also think is interesting is, as much as I quote unquote knew, I also didn't know anything. And I think, like many young women, it took me a long time to experience my first orgasm. You know, like years, like early 20s. And I thought I knew, like I thought I knew a lot. And I think that also has helped me recognize the challenges that a lot of people face with exploring all of that. But I was always very curious. I was definitely curious and open to experiences, I think. I never felt any shame or guilt around sexuality or, you know, exploring pleasure or even starting to ask for what I wanted. I think I did do that earlier than a lot of people.
Do you think a lot of the challenge, particularly with women not experiencing orgasm, is that they don't take the time to fully explore their own bodies? They don't have a pleasure practice. They don't fully understand what masturbation is and how it feels good, and that they somehow link sex to something you do with somebody else. Therefore, it's I'm going to get pleasure from it, as opposed to what is my desire? What do I actually want from this whole experience?
Absolutely. I think that is one of the biggest challenges. And that's one thing that I do work with my clients on is learning. And actually, I was one of those people. I depended on my partner for my pleasure, for my orgasms for many, many, many years until I figured it out on my own. And I think, you know, one part is women don't know their bodies. They don't explore. I think the other part of it is they don't realize how long it takes for our bodies to become fully aroused. You know, the joke that I've made for years is men are like microwaves, beep, 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 they're hot. And women are like ovens. We have to preheat. And I think so many women throw in the towel and say, oh, it's not going to happen for me tonight. When it will, they just haven't given their bodies that full up to 20 to 40 minutes to get aroused. And they just kind of get stuck in the part where it doesn't really feel like a whole heck of a lot. And, you know, whether they don't know how to explore their bodies or they don't know how to ask their partner or their partner doesn't know that it takes them that long. Mm-hmm. You know, for so many women, the experience is over for them before it ever really begun.
I can imagine men at the listening thinking, 40 minutes? Fuck that. What?
Yeah, and let me be clear too. I'm not talking about 40 minutes of thrusting here either.
No. So. Even 40 minutes, the whole thing. Well, 40 minutes? With whole place, yeah. 40 minutes? And it's like, well, really?
Yeah. But you know, that's where different, you know, tools, you know, toys, yeah, things like that can come in. And you know, that 40 minutes is going to be typically a little bit later on in life, as you know, perimenopausal, postmenopausal, things like that. Younger women, it'll be a little bit less, but it varies. It varies throughout our lifetime, just like things vary for men.
Absolutely. And so from being this curious individual, person that's willing to explore and to ask for what she desires, then there's still a step beyond that to become, right, I'm going to get the flag now and have the sexologist title. So was that somewhere you've always felt you were called towards?
No, you know, I learned about the profession of sexology, I guess about 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. But previous to that, I had, for many, many years, I had been doing in-home sex toy parties. So especially when my children were little, because I was staying at home with them during the day. And then I wanted to be able to go and work and get out of the house a little bit and make a little bit of extra money. So I don't know if they have, I think they have it in UK, but I would go into, you know, I'd be invited to somebody's house. I'd bring a bunch of toys and I would teach and show the different products and sell them. And my favorite part of that and the compliment that I got over and over and over again was, I learned more from you than I have at any of these parties ever before. And it was the teaching aspect of it that just lit me up. And then as my children got older and so many of their things were happening on the weekends, I didn't want to work on the weekends anymore. I wanted to work during the week when they were in school. And that's when I started trying to figure out how this skill set of mine about teaching about sex and people having more pleasure and passion in their lives, how I could do something different with that. And when I discovered the sexology certification, I was elated. And so that is why I, you know, went ahead and pursued that. It took me well over a year and it was the most fun studying I've ever had in my entire life. And that's, you know, how I kind of got here.
And has experience after the studying and going into practice, has it been what you hoped it would be?
100%. I think that seeing my clients like grow and transform and watching, you know, normally when I have clients that come to me, they just look so defeated and sad and like they don't have any hope, hopeless. And week after week, or every session that I have with them, I start to see just more lightness and smile, you know, come into their face as they learn different things, they try different things. I get texts, "Oh my gosh, Amy, you'll never believe the experience I had last night." And I get to cheer them on for it. And of course, for most people, if you have a really amazing sexual experience, are you texting anybody about that other than perhaps the person that you just had that with? Like, you're not going to tell your sister. You're not going to tell your, I mean, you might, but very few people will. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's just really wonderful for people to have that space to learn, to be celebrated, and just to recognize that so many things are natural and normal that you just didn't ever know.
Hmm. So how would you describe what a sexologist does? I mean, so we hear, you know, sex therapists, sex coaches, sex educators. How would you define what a sexologist, or what clients would look for when they come to a sexologist?
I think it's very individual, because a sexologist is, it's sort of a general certification, if you will, that just says that you have been taught about in deep about various aspects of sex and intimacy, but people take it in many, many different directions. So for me specifically, I work as a sex and intimacy coach. So yeah. I do talk-based sessions primarily with women and couples. I do have some men clients as well, just mm-hmm. helping them with overcome different intimacy challenges. I teach workshops. I also still sell a lot of products. You know, I think some sexologists, you know, end up, you know, as advisors for companies, you know, that are like making sex toys, things like that. So there's a lot of different directions you can go mm-hmm. with it, and which I think is both exciting and it can be a little intimidating, because there isn't necessarily a clear path to follow. Mm. So that, again, is exciting, but also can be challenging.
One of the things that I often think about, whether it's regular therapy or coaching or sex therapy or sexology or whatever, that people tend to gravitate towards that sort of help, particularly when it comes to sort of sex and intimacy, when they feel that things have gone wrong or awry or something's not working. You don't tend to get people that, almost like we take our car in once a year just for a checkup. Do people tend to represent to you with, "This is my problem." It might not be the problem at all, but as you get down to that, once you start meeting with them, talking to them, as opposed to, "Everything's wonderful, we're looking to have even better sex, what can you do to help us?" Does it tend to be the fix a problem kind of thing?
I do tend to attract more of the fix a problem type of clients, which I love working, you know, and I think to what you're getting at a little bit is there's sort of the problem side, and then there's the pleasure side. And I do both. It's really wonderful when I have a client that comes to me and they say, you know, things are pretty good. Like, you know, our marriage is fine, we're enjoying things, but we just think that there's more and we don't even know how to begin to explore that. Can you help with that? And I love getting couples in that stage as well, because I think what so many people don't realize is that there is truly no end to the type and amount of pleasure that you can experience and explore if you're open to it. And if you and your partner are willing to have some conversations and try some different things. You know, my husband and I, we went through our own sort of, you know, personal sexual renaissance, if you will, about 5 years ago, and opened all these doors that we didn't even know existed. And that has built our marriage, which was already pretty good, you know, in so many different ways, and has just really helped us, you know, grow in ways that, you know, it's difficult to explain, but as life gets hard, which it does, you know, as there's different challenges that come up, like when we are really stressed, we find ways to connect in the bedroom. Mm-hmm. And then that makes so many of the things that happen outside of the bedroom a lot easier. Because we just know that we have each other's back in both ways. And so, you know, but on the flip side, with the problem side, you know, when people come to me, and that is where most of my clients come from, a lot of it is just, you know, is this a relationship issue? Is this, they just need some education. A lot of it is mindset. There's so much mindset. There's just a lot of negative mindset things that happen there. And I've always seen myself as the person who puts the puzzle together where they've been to a doctor, they've been to a couples therapist, they've been to all these different places and they have little tiny pieces of it. And while I'm not a doctor and I'm not a licensed therapist, I have enough knowledge in a lot of the realms to be able to help put it together and then give them a path to get from where they are now to where they want to go.
Because it doesn't, although many handbooks are available, it doesn't come with handbooks. So you start a relationship with somebody and you know, it's the first few weeks, months, oh my goodness, you're having sort of sex all the time. It's incredible. And then many people settle into a routine, which is fine. And then perhaps, like you say, find themselves a little bit later on. It could be a year, 5 years, 20 years, who knows what. And some of the things you mentioned, your website, I think mismatched libido, too tired, too busy, pain, dysfunction, lots of things that come up, but some of which are physical ailments, but many which, like you say, are emotional or mental things to overcome. And do you find that you often have to sort of dig beneath the surface to get to, because if something comes to you and say, look, our libido's mismatched. My husband, he seems to want sex all the time. I don't want sex that often. Husband's thinking, I don't want sex all the time. Just once a week would be nice. And she's thinking, is it almost the problem they manifest with actually requires some peeling back of the layers to get to where actually, okay, let's get back to this stage and then make a solid build up from there. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. And yes, that's exactly what I do, because I think the most common complaint that I get is exactly what you described, which is, you know, husband wants sex all the time, you know, quote unquote, and the wife is so sick of being bothered. And, you know, typically once I dig into it, you know, first of all, I have to find out what is sex all the time mean, you know, what is sort of frequency. And ultimately what it usually is that the husband, both the husband and wife want sex that is emotionally fulfilling. And when they are experiencing more emotionally fulfilling sex, that will naturally lead to an increased frequency of sex because both people are getting something in the sexual experience. And so frequently what is happening is that the woman is just doing it for him, you know, okay, fine. I want you to stop bothering me. Fine. We can just have sex. And then they have sex. She doesn't really enjoy it. Or maybe she even does have an orgasm, but it's just kind of following the motions. You know, they just do the same things that they're always doing. And at the end, like, yeah, sure. He got sex and she, you know, did this for him, but what was in that really for her? And when that's the pattern that's repeated over and over again, then yeah, she's going to want less and less sex. And so investing and helping them connect emotionally outside the bedroom is the biggest building block to building intimacy inside the bedroom. And it's just figuring out what that looks like. Because in the crazy busyness of everyday life, of kids and jobs and stress and all of the things that happen, it is just easy to fall into habits, ruts, you know, naturally disconnection, because so much of our lives are really pulling us apart. And you have to be very intentional about the time that you spend together and how you spend it.
Yeah, that's really well put. And I often think life would be a lot easier if we replace the word sex with intimacy or pleasure. Because sex tends to indicate for most heteronormative couples, penis in vagina, man ejaculates, that's sex basically. Woman has an orgasm, what she doesn't, that's sex. But like you said, what's the dynamic outside the bedroom? Do you hold hands when you go out? Do you brush the hair from her face when you sit down for dinner? Do you put your hand in the small of her back when you're walking along? Does she rub your feet when you're sitting on the sofa? Is there any physical connectivity outside the bedroom? Because if there isn't, and so going to the bedroom side, right, come on. It feels so disjointed. It's a bit like having an Olympic sprinter. So do you do any training or any running or anything? No, I just turn up for the events and just run. Well, yeah. You're probably not going to be as good as you would be if you actually, you know, did some short sprints, some longer sprints, some stretching, some massage, all those things. And you've probably found the same, that you can get a very erotic, incredible, desirable pleasure from somebody brushing your hair, or somebody stroking your back, or somebody giving you a massage, or somebody just looking at you, for goodness sake. But we seem to have this thing about, no, it's sex. I've got to have sex. And that's I think one of the big things that I'd love young people to recognize, that sex isn't just intercourse. That's part of it, which is great, but there's so much more to it than that. And is that something you try and educate and guide your clients towards, that sort of much broader aspect of what intimacy can feel like?
Absolutely. I love that you brought this up, because this is, I think, a soapbox of mine as well, because again, the definition most people have of sex, right, is we kiss, touch, do this, penis and vagina, orgasm happens or doesn't happen, and then we roll over and go to bed. Yeah. And that has a place, but if that is what's happening every time, then again, that's why a lot of things aren't working. The pleasure oriented view of sex versus the goal oriented view of sex. Mm. The goal oriented view of sex is, I have to give you an orgasm and I have an orgasm, right? That's the goal. Mm-hmm. There is so much pleasure that can be baked in. Again, and to your point, it shouldn't start when you get in bed. If the first time that you are paying attention to your partner is when you guys have gotten in bed at night, if the first time that you have touched them or talked to them or asked them a question about their day is that night, you have missed the whole window. Yeah. It should be starting from when the sun comes up, and finding those little moments of pleasure and connection and touching. You know, physical touch is so, so important, because it produces oxytocin, which is, of course, the love, bond, trust hormone. And that produces all of the good feelings. And it's also a natural antidote to stress. It reduces cortisol. So when you're feeling really, really stressed out, the best thing you can do is lean into your partner, kiss them, hug them, go have an orgasm. But I think so many couples, when they're stressed out, they turn away from each other. One thing that my husband and I discovered, I don't know how we discovered it, but you know, many years ago, but like, if one of us was having a really, really bad day, we would do something we called kiss therapy, which is just like little tiny kisses all over the faces of the other person, just itty bitty little kisses, like butterfly kisses. And it was amazing how maybe 30 seconds to 1 minute of that would just like, just help you calm down, help you feel so much better. And then that person is caring for you and nurturing you and recognizing that you're going through a hard time and not taking it personally and not ignoring it and not trying to solve it or fix it, but just saying, hey, I'm here for you. I'm going to help you feel a little bit better. And I do kiss therapy for him as well, because you know what? He has bad days too.
I like that. I mean, I do find that a lot of people that I know and talk to, that exactly the same. I think because now we have these, we're surrounded by digital devices, which are amazing and allow us to do wonderful things. But often people will come home and they'll either carry on working on the device, or they'll go straight to their phone or the iPhone or whatever, and communicate with people outside the house. And like I said, the first time they sort of put the phone down, if they're fortunate, is just before they get into bed, and it's like, right, okay, now I'm here now. Well, where have you been for the last 3 or 4 hours? And that's, yeah, I do think that almost crazy irony that we have the ability to connect with people all over the world now. But for many people, it feels like we've more disconnected than ever before. I know there's a loneliness epidemic, and then people are struggling to meet people. People are living in a single person household and not dating, because they struggle to have that conversation and to talk and to communicate. And for couples that perhaps have somewhere in the midst of time, they sort of lost the ability to communicate with one another, or at least they feel, one person feels hesitant to talk about something they might want to try or don't want to do anymore. Or how do you help people almost create a safe space for those conversations? Because none of us want to be mocked or laughed or thought to be a pervert or whatever. So you almost help people create that safe space to have that conversation about intimacy.
I think the first thing, obviously, is making sure that there is just a base level of trust and emotional intimacy. Yeah. And, you know, to your point about the devices, we feel so connected and disconnected at the same time. And, you know, even just taking 15 minutes of each day, hopefully more, but you can start with 15 minutes and making sure that you both put down your devices and you just genuinely ask the other person about their day and, you know, what went well, and then just listen. My husband, he does something in fibers and I don't know. I listen to his calls all day long because we both work from home. And I don't understand what he does, but he will come to me and he will just vent about this and this and this. And I just listen. And then I say, you know what? I think you're doing an amazing job, honey. Like, I'm so proud of you. Thank you for doing what you do for our family. Do I get it? No. Does he know that I care about what he does and that what I think he does is important? And that, you know, and that I have him in whatever, you know, he needs, absolutely. And vice versa. He does the same thing for me. He asks me about my day. He listens when I have things that I need to vent about. If I'm getting really upset or frustrated about something, he doesn't, you know, tell me, you know, just get over it or anything like that. Like he hugs me and he says, I think you're doing an amazing job. You're a wonderful mom. You're working hard. I believe in you. And that atmosphere of trust where we know that we can go to each other with stress and all of that, and it doesn't create conflict. We just support each other. I think that's the beginning of it. And then when it comes to moving into intimacy in the bedroom, you know, once you have that basis of trust, it's not hard to bring up those conversations. But I will give you an example, because I mentioned 5 years ago, we sort of had a expansion of our own, you know, sexual repertoire. And it came out of my husband sharing something that he apparently had been thinking about for many, many years and was very, very nervous to ask if it was something that I would be interested in. And finally, on an anniversary weekend trip, he brought it up. And do you want me to tell you what it was?
If you're comfortable.
He wanted me to wear a pair of thigh-high socks. That's it. That's all it was.
My imagination was not going there, believe me.
I know. But what was interesting to me was how nervous he felt about asking for that, because would I take it wrong? Would I think that he always needed that? Would I think that he hadn't been enjoying everything we'd done before because I wasn't wearing socks? It's such a loaded, or can feel like a very loaded thing to ask for something. And of course, he asked, and I mean, I was surprised, but not in a negative way. I was just like, oh, I mean, okay, sure, I'll put on some socks for you. And with my acquiescence to that request, then that enabled me to start to think about some of my own things and ask for that. And then that opened the door for him to start expanding more of the things that he wanted. And so an easy way to sort of bring something up is, you know, I'm curious, have you ever, this is something I'm curious to try, you know, would you consider it? Or what do you think about this? You don't ever want to bring up something like this in the bedroom though. Don't surprise people with something new. You know, it's a great time. You know, maybe if you had really great sex the night before and you're both in a good mood the next morning, drinking some coffee, you know, hey, this is something I've really been thinking about. And, you know, I'm not sure if this is something that you would be interested in, but I'm kind of curious, you know, what do you think? And leaving space for a conversation, you know, a maybe isn't a no, a maybe is, you know, I might have to think about it. Yeah. And that's an opening. So, you know, just having those conversations, finding safe ways to explore. And I think especially once you've had the first one and kind of opened the door and tried something new together, I think it makes it really, really easy to continue that process in whatever way that feels safe for you as a couple.
So how many pairs of thigh-high socks do you have now?
Oh God, a lot. it's expanded into skirts and all kinds of things. I mean, it's, yeah, there is a massive collection. Yeah.
I think often people are nervous to share their, no, let me rephrase that. I think people sometimes get confused between what they might fantasize about and the things that they would like to try. And I think a fantasy is, you know, I might fantasize about scoring the winning touchdown in the Super Bowl. It's not going to happen. but I can go out and throw a ball around with my son and have a great time. I might fantasize about, being with somebody completely new, somebody that I've never seen before. But actually, in reality, what I might want to do is meet my wife, who's pretending to be a stranger in a hotel bar, and we go to the hotel room, and we don't know each other, we don't share each other's names. But that's what I want to try. And I think sometimes we think, well, fantasy. Oh my gosh, I'm fantasizing about having a threesome, or whatever. But I have no desire to actually try it. It's how you can sort of almost interpret the fantasy, I guess. Because you know, there's lots of there's a big genre of books now. I think it's called romanticy, sort of romance but fantasy with dragons and werewolves and whatever else. Nobody really wants to have sex with a dragon, but there's something in there about maybe being the helpless or being taken or whatever that you can translate into the bedroom. And I think that's the fun part of it, I guess. It's just hopefully being able to talk about those funny things and think, oh, what might we do and how could we do this? And thinking about maybe role play or cosplay or whatever. And yeah, I think there's so much to explore. But like I say, it does just take having that conversation and the other person giving you the space and listening, really, and not straight away going, oh my God, what? And
yeah.
Because they're never going to raise anything again. That's it, really. They've tried. And yeah.
Sure.
I wanted to change the tone a little bit. So just to forewarn people, this is not necessarily the, although it has a happy ending, thankfully. But if you're okay, I just wanted to touch on, and I'm not sure if it's the right word, but your battle with cancer or your success over cancer. And the reason I'm asking this, I know it impacted your self-image and the sense of yourself as a sexual desirable woman. And I wonder what, would you be comfortable telling us what it was like to have cancer and also be somebody's partner and how that all felt?
Of course. I'm glad you asked that question, and I'm happy to share because it is something that really just isn't talked about. And I remember when I was diagnosed, among the many, many things I was Googling in that time, one of them was, what would sex look like? And Google was not very helpful. But going briefly into my journey, when I was 38 years old, I found a lump up in my chest wall. I went to the doctor. The doctor felt the lump. She said, I'm not worried about this. I don't think it's cancer, but I'll just go ahead and send you for a mammogram just in case. And I went for my first and what turned out to be my last mammogram and learned that I had stage 0 cancer, which I did not even know existed. No. It was called ductal carcinoma in situ. And what it meant was I had cancerous cells that were spreading all throughout my right breast. They were still contained within the milk ducts, so it had not become invasive yet. So that's why it was stage 0 cancer. But the word cancer was still in there. Yeah. And it was absolutely terrifying and a complete shock, and launched into what ended up being 2 years of surgeries and things like that. Because I caught it as early as I did not have to go through chemo and radiation. And also because I elected to have a double mastectomy, which was not, you know, an easy choice or an easy path. But I am exceptionally, exceptionally grateful that because I had that option and because I chose that option, that I didn't have to have further treatment. But having a double mastectomy at age 38, was really, really hard. At the time, I was very angry about it. I felt like my body failed me. I was obviously very concerned about losing a part of, you know, sort of what defined me as a woman. Not that I ever felt like I had like the most amazing breasts in the world, but, you know, I mean, they were part of me and I didn't want to not have them anymore. And I didn't know what I was going to look like when I woke up. I didn't know. I was losing both of my nipples, so I was going to be losing a big erogenous zone. And I just, you know, I just didn't know what things were going to look like for me on the other side, which was very scary. And I also recognize, again, how lucky that I was that after the double mastectomy, I didn't have to go into longer treatment. And so I was able to sort of start recovering that side of myself faster than I think a lot of other breast cancer survivors. Yeah. But there is just such a reckoning that happens there of, you know, who am I as a woman and what are things going to feel like? As part of my reconstruction, they use my ab muscles to reconstruct my breasts. So that meant in addition to everything that happened up here, I had a major abdominal surgery as well. And abdominal surgery is in the pelvic area, and that affects all of the blood flow down there. And even though I wasn't a sexologist yet, I certainly knew enough to know that, you know, blood flow is the key to all of arousal for men and for women in the pelvic area. So I was genuinely concerned, like, will I still be able to experience pleasure? Like, are my orgasms going to be affected? You know, a lot of things like that. Mm. And I don't think that I asked the doctor, but even if I had, I'm sure they would not have had any answers for me on that. So I just had to figure out what to do, you know, with James and my husband. And I'm very grateful that he was incredibly patient and very supportive about as I made all these decisions and as I was ready to start, you know, on the other end of the first surgery, as I was ready to start figuring out what things look like for me after.
Hmm. And how long have you been cancer-free for now?
I'm coming up on, I just celebrated 8 years. So yeah, 8 years cancer-free. And I'm happy to report from a sex and intimacy perspective that things are better than ever, you know, even better than they were in the first place. And you know, the decision that I made, and I'm not saying this is the right decision for everybody, but the decision that I made and that I feel like I want to offer and give permission to anyone who's going through, and it doesn't have to be a double mastectomy or even breast cancer, but any sort of major body disfiguring surgery, things like that, like something that really affects a large part of your body. I think there's just a lot of fear. There's a lot of fear of what's going to happen and how am I going to feel? And the decision that I made after, I think it was 2, maybe 3 weeks of this major surgery, I think I'd just gotten, I had 6 drains. I just got all the drains out. But I remember looking at James and saying, I need to know if my body still works. I just need to know. And so I said, can we please try? And you know, of course he was game. Yeah. But you know, I was still very sore, you know, so there were lots of pillows involved. It was very slow. It was very gentle. But I learned that my body did still work. And that was very, very reassuring for me. And so for me, I needed that reassurance early on. I think for other people, it might take longer, which is also perfectly okay. Yeah. But I think the thing that I want to offer is if it's fear that's holding you back, I think sometimes the best way to help with that is to go ahead and face that fear. And because you don't know until you try. And so, you know, just finding a way to be comfortable, finding a way to make it work, recognizing things are going to be different and that's okay. But there's ways to create different erogenous zones, new erogenous zones. I would venture to say there's parts of my body now that are more sensitive that weren't because I lost part of my erogenous zone. So like my neck is a lot more sensitive. I have other areas that we've focused a lot more attention on since then. And things are wonderful there.
So something that I've talked to some other people that have sadly had cancer or different serious illness is obviously the doctors that they go and see, or you go and see the specialists, the oncologists, etc. Incredible at what they do, and they fix the problem hopefully. But the people I talked to said, well, they don't really talk about sex and intimacy afterwards, that their job is to fix the issue, whether it's a, you know, it's a heart disease or it's cancer, whatever it is, to try and fix the issue and get past it. And they were saying, people sort of said, well, when they ask the question, well, when can I start having sex again? So the best answer they tend to get is, well, just when you feel up to it, but just take it easy the first few times. And I think it would be great if as part of the sort of care package, in a way, that was part of the discussion, the intimacy and sensuality and sex, et cetera, were part of the discussion about, yeah, life, living life afterwards. So did you get much guidance from your oncologists and cancer specialists?
No, none, no. And to your point, yes, these doctors are incredible and they're lifesavers, and they you know, really perform absolute miracles. But doctors, medical doctors, are not trained in sex and intimacy. They get less than 10 hours of sex and intimacy training in medical school, and it's just not their wheelhouse, which is fine. We need them to help with cancer treatments, so thank you for that. However, I agree, and you know, my pie in the sky dream, I wish that every OBGYN office, I wish that oncologist offices had, whether it was a sexologist, a sex therapist, had a sex expert built in to their treatment plan. You know, how amazing would it be when you go for your annual exam at the OBGYN, speaking to women, you know, here, absolutely, that after you have your exam, after you have your pap smear, if someone else came into the room and they said, hi, I'm a sex and intimacy specialist, is there anything that's going on that I can help you with? Because a lot of people just ask their doctors and their doctors don't have answers. And then they might ask a therapist. If the therapist isn't trained in sex and intimacy, they don't have answers. And then they're just like, well, I don't even know where to go. Mm. And a lot of people just resign themselves to, well, I guess this is how it is. So I do think it should be a part of that entire package. You know, my first appointment with my doctors after my diagnosis, it was really was amazing, because I've had many people diagnosed in my life since then. But my first appointment, my oncologist, my radiologist, my psychiatrist, and my breast surgeon were all in the same room, and they'd spent 30 minutes talking about me and coming up with my treatment plan together. So I didn't have to go to lots of different places.
Yeah, that's good.
And it would be really amazing if there was a sex and intimacy professional that was part of that room.
Mm-hmm. Because it is and should be just a very important part of people's lives. There's so much more research coming out now that shows people with a happier, healthier sex and intimacy life are better managers and better bosses and all things. Well, how can that be connected? Well, if you're going to work with a smile on your face, it's better than going to work feeling miserable and depressed, isn't it? So yeah, people somehow think of sex as being somehow something separate from life, but it's a big part of life, hopefully. And something I did want to talk about, and there was an episode on your podcast, it was what to do if you don't want sex after 40. And that did make me think, so I'm obviously quite away after 40. I'm sort of mid-50s now. My wife's turning 50 this year. And we're going through the sort of phases of life where it's perimenopause, menopause, you know, I don't always get an erection, or it doesn't stay hard for as long, etc. And I think for a lot of people, it's probably quite easy at that point just to think, well, okay, we've sort of had our sex lives now, really. Now it's now we can cuddle now and stuff, but we're not really, sex isn't really part of our future, really. And first of all, the thoughts makes me incredibly sad. And secondly, particularly with women going through menopause and some of the physical and emotional challenges that brings about, how can people continue to have, yeah, and I'll say it, amazing sex and intimacy into their 50s, 60s, 70s and beyond? That's a big question. So
it is a big question, but there actually is a simple answer, if you will. Mm-hmm. And it's that, and we've touched on it already, you have to think about sex differently.
Yes.
And we talked about the definition of sex that so many people have been prescribing to is, you know, penis and vagina intercourse. And, you know, I think what comes in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and beyond is, again, physical challenges start to come up. All of a sudden, men's erections aren't behaving that they have been, you know, all of their life. And, you know, women, we're experiencing all these big, huge hormonal shifts. And whereas you might have previously had a very healthy libido, all of a sudden it's gone. And obviously, with both of those situations, the first thing to always do is go consult with the doctor. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, especially for men, erection issues can be a first sign of some sort of medical issue, heart disease, things like that. So the first thing you always want to do is get to a doctor and get to a doctor quickly. Just check things out, rule anything out. And women, have your hormones checked, hormone optimization. There's so much more conversation around that these days, which I think is really wonderful. And you know, sometimes, you know, a little tweak in hormones and, you know, some medication or maybe like some, you know, circulation medication or something for the man might help a lot with some of the physical challenges. Mm-hmm. However, if those still exist, and let's be honest, especially as we move into 60s, 70s, 80s, our bodies just are not going to work the same way that they did when we were in our 20s and 30s. But that doesn't mean that pleasure is off the table, because there are so many different ways of exploring and playing, and you just have to get a little bit more creative. Now, I'm going to say, why wait until your 60s and 70s to get that creative? You can start that right now. And that's where, I mean, there's so many wonderful toys that come in. You know, we also have hands and we have mouths and we have tongues, and there, our entire body, our skin is a whole erogenous zone. And so when you stop just focusing on the genitals and start exploring all of these different areas, you can experience orgasms and pleasure when you aren't even on the genitals, once you've learned how to do it and learned how to enhance those sensations. And so then I think that's a lot of where sensuality comes into play. And, you know, especially when you're older, when your kids are out of the house, all of a sudden you have a lot of time, so much more time than you had. And I have people that come to me, they're like, we have all this time now, but we don't know what to do with it. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like, do you would like me to plan that out for you? Because I will, I cannot, I mean, I'm sure I'll be sad when my children are out of the house, but also I'm really looking forward to it. But, you know, having like one day a week where, yeah, I don't know, it's intimacy day, it's pleasure day, you know, set up, you know, create a scenario, or maybe just, you know, put some silk sheets on the bed and some gentle lights and, you know, play with sensations. I mean, there's really no end to the different types of things that you can experience and explore once you break out of that mold of what we have been taught sex is. And I think that's the key at 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, but don't wait that long.
It's funny, and I hope my wife doesn't hear this necessarily, but before we had children, we used to have naked day.
I love it.
Every couple of weeks or whatever, we'd have a day where, as the name suggests, we'd spend the day in the house just naked. And I was going to ask you about that. So we talked a bit before we started about having, we've got sort of teenage kids now, that, you know, within a couple of years, they'll both be out of the house. And it's, part of me is really excited, but I'm obviously, I miss them terribly, but part of me is excited by that. And part of me is a bit nervous. Because we've always had, our focus has always been primarily on the children. And I think that's what we decided, and the focus on ourselves has perhaps been a little bit less. And yeah, there's that slightly nervous thing about, yeah, what if we sort of look around and think, oh, it's just me and you now, is it? So, and I'm sort of answering my own questions and asking them really. I guess the thing is not to wait till a minute they're both gone and say, well, but oh, okay, is to start talking now about what our amazing future feels like, really. See, this can, it should be different, shouldn't it, when there's just two of you in the house and you can do things with the drop of a hat, or you can get back to having naked day or whatever.
Yeah,
although we're quite a bit older now, but yeah, I'm sure we're quite but yes, I guess, yeah, it's just, yeah, well, you already said it, but don't wait until something happens. Start working on it now.
But I think to your point too is, if you've neglected your connection, if you've neglected your sex life, if you haven't been having those conversations all along, then when the day comes that the children are gone and you do have that freedom and you look at each other and you're like, I mean, I don't, like, I think I still like him, but I, you know, like, I don't, who is this person? And are we still connected? And I think that's why that intentional intimacy, and again, I'm not even just talking about sex here, but just intentional emotional intimacy, non-sexual physical intimacy, purposefully taking time to spend with each other on a regular basis, especially when you have kids in the house, it's so, so important. James and I, we play board games, like pretty detailed, extensive, strategic ones. Like, I'm not talking Monopoly here, but we play games just about every Wednesday night, sometimes more than that. We just really enjoy, we learn games together. And it's just a lot of fun. There's a little competition. And yeah, we usually end up in the bedroom after that, after these teenagers that never go to sleep finally go to sleep. But we end up, you know, we typically end up staying up later than I would like. However, one thing that I really appreciate that my husband does, and this might be a little tip and possibly controversial, but he knows that I need more sleep and he knows that I function and much better with more sleep. And therefore our entire family functions much better when I've had enough sleep. And so if we stay up late waiting out these teenagers so that we can have sex that night, almost always he will make sure that I get to sleep in whatever that looks like. And he will get up and do whatever morning things need to happen. And I'm not sleeping till like 10 or 11 here. I might just be till 8 o'clock, but he's
sleeping then. Oh my goodness.
But that takes one worry off of my list, because I think one reason why a lot of people say, no, I don't want to have sex tonight, is because I'm going to be tired the next morning. It's too late. Yeah. And so him ensuring that I get that extra hour of sleep opens up an extra hour the night before for us to be able to have a little bit more fun. And he's become very adept at knowing the things that I need to help reduce my stress, to open up a lot more space for me to be willing to say yes. And I, you know, very, very rarely turn him down. Every once in a while I do, every once in a while, but it's never a problem, because if I'm like, I really am legitimately tired. I've got a big day tomorrow. I've got to be up at 7. But how about we try for tomorrow night? And it's never a problem.
Do you ever instigate sex?
You know, that's an interesting question, and not very frequently. And I asked my husband about this not too long ago. I said, do you wish that I initiated more? I would say, I mean, I probably initiate maybe 5% of the time. I really don't initiate very frequently, like purposefully initiate. Yeah. Now, that said, while I'm not typically initiating, I do give signals. And I think that a lot of couples kind of signal back and forth. And so, you know, he says he can tell if I'm interested, probably because I'm being a little more touchy, I'm being a little more kissy, things like that. And so then that will signal to him and he will initiate. So that might count as an initiation. And if that's the case, then I probably do initiate, you know, 50 to 60% of the time. I don't know. It's hard to know. But as far as direct initiation, very rarely.
Yeah, I think most research says the same thing, that there is that almost, that subtle sort of pre-initiation, that if you were to initiate, then you might find, I'm quite receptive to your initiation, but I'm not gonna initiate. It's almost that, yeah, it is. And again, as the partner, and so in some relationships, women initiate all the time. In others, we're the same as you. It's probably about 5% direct initiation by my partner, if that. But there's that, I can sort of generally tell when the sort of welcoming, warmer, more conversational. Yeah, we've sat on the sofa together, closer than normal, and all those sort of things. So, yeah. So we both got teenage children, and I think I'm sure the US and for lots of political reasons, and the UK, we perhaps don't see the sex education that we'd want children to get at school or education, also education. So when and how do you think we as parents or carers or grandparents or whoever the dynamic is, should talk to our children about sex and intimacy, kink and love relationships, porn as well. When should we have those conversations?
Great question, and such an important question, because I think parents are terrified. So many parents are so afraid to talk about this with their kids. One, because they don't know what to say. It feels a little embarrassing. Yeah. Two, they're afraid they might put ideas in their head or make them want to do, you know, something that it's, you know, we don't necessarily want to encourage our teenagers, but we know that they're going to get into things. But I am a firm believer that, that the more information you have, that just helps you make better educated decisions. But when should this conversation start? This conversation should start when they are little, one, two, with body parts, right? With naming and giving them proper names, penis, vagina, vulva, testicles. Don't do cutesy names. And letting them know what their body parts are and what are private areas, and anything covered by a bathing suit is a private area. And nobody should be touching that other than mom, dad, or a doctor if mom or dad are in the room. You know, that's it. And that's basic safety.
Yeah.
Going into the mechanics of actual sex, 8 is a really great age to start that conversation. And it shouldn't just be a talk. It shouldn't be, I'm going to sit down for 1 hour and I'm going to tell you every single thing you need to know about sex. This is 25 minute conversations. These are just different things that you're interspersing here and there. Yeah. But the reason I recommend the age of 8 to explain the mechanics of it is because they're old enough to understand, but they're not too old where it starts to be super embarrassing yet. You know, once they head into the tween age, that's when it's like, ew, mom, you know, they know a little more and things start to be embarrassing. So 8 is a great age to, you know, when a penis goes into a vagina, you know, those types of things. And, but I think even more importantly, part of that conversation should be about not just defining sex as penis and vagina sex. Incorporating the pleasure part into the conversation, that's pretty controversial. And I know that it's certainly not in sex ed curriculums in the United States either. Yes. There is a really wonderful website that I recommend that I shared with my kids when they were probably 12 or 13 called amaze.org. And it's a lot of evidence-based videos, but it's cartoons and stuff, and it's geared towards, you know, teenagers. And they do talk about pleasure, and they do talk about masturbation, and they talk about all different types of relationships and connections. Because it, also, sex is not just penis and vagina sex, because that's also leaving out LGBTQ, you know, the whole swath of the population that may not engage in penis and vagina sex for whatever reason. So I think the important thing is for a parent to talk about it in a way that feels open and supportive, and leave the door open for conversations. You're welcome to ask me whatever questions you like. Books were a really good resource for my kids. Two of my kids did not ask me any questions at all. And one of them asked me some very surprising questions, like, can I see the egg in your period blood? And I was like, I was not ready for that question. And no, I don't think you can. It's very surprising what they're going to come up with. But just leaving that door open. And now that my oldest son, he's 17, he has a girlfriend. I know that they have a sexual relationship because I have a drawer of condoms that they're welcome to go into. Any teenagers that come in my house, no questions asked, it's just full. And, you know, it gets empty. But he's come up and asked me a few things now. And I've just left that space. I said, you know, whenever you're ready, if you've got some questions, I'm here for you. And if you don't want to talk to me, which I understand because it might be embarrassing because I'm your mom, let me know. I'm happy to connect you with someone else who can answer those questions for you. And when I told him that, he said, Mom, why would I want to ask somebody else? The only person I'd want to talk to about this is you. And that felt really good.
Best I cry and hug him. That's a fabulous thing. Because and part of the reason I asked is that there's a new study that came out in the UK yesterday. It's one of the biggest studies that there's been on young people and access and influence of porn. And I think they found that 25% of 11-year-olds have accessed hardcore porn and something like 90% of 13-year-olds. And I certainly know when I was 11, I don't think I even thought about anything like that when I was 11. When I was 13, I still really didn't know much about the whole thing at all. And porn is a bit like a bit like watching a regular film in that it's entertainment. It's not prescriptive. It's not educational. It's not something that people should see and think, no, that's what I should do. And one of the things that they found during this research was that there's a lot more expectation from young men about some things that you might think have been as extreme or unsafe, sort of choking and those sort of things. And it's, I think it's really important to not sort of close your eyes and I'm sure my son or daughter isn't looking at that, because they are. And you can't avoid it. You go into X or whatever else, and unless you are incredibly careful, it's just there. And then once you've seen it, and particularly if you go into some of the big almost porn clip sites, they're sort of clipped into 5 minute, 3 minute, whatever sort of length of clips they are. And there's obviously no talk about consent or desire or anything, nothing. It's just a very, very physical act. And it can range from some that's potentially quite loving, but some that really is very uncomfortable. So I do think, again, like you said, having that conversation quite early, because people are seeing hardcore porn at 11. So if you wait until you think they're old enough to have sex, shouldn't I have sex before they're 16?
It's way too late.
That horse literally.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think so, again, so many children are stumbling across porn accidentally or somebody showing it to them. My son did tell me years later that he was at a sleepover. He was probably 11 or 12. And, my kids didn't get phones until they were like 13, 14, but this child had a phone and they were at a sleepover and he was like, hey, look at this. And he showed my son porn. And I understand the curiosity. The curiosity, I think, is completely natural and normal. There's nothing wrong with that. Kids experience sexual feelings and sexual thoughts very, very young. Yeah. And I know that's controversial to say, but it's true. And so the curiosity is there and natural. But if you aren't having the conversation, if you aren't giving them good resources, they are going to learn things in other ways. And the conversation around consent especially is incredibly, incredibly important. And, to your point, when they're learning all these things from porn, it just starts, it ends. Women are having orgasms in 2 seconds. And, there are so many reports about, 16, 17-year-olds like trying to like choke their girlfriend because they think they've seen it in porn and the woman liked it in porn. So they think that this is normal and this is how it works. And a lot of times she also doesn't know, maybe I am supposed to like this. I don't know, because she doesn't know either. And she's not speaking up yet because she doesn't know her body. She's, they're learning learning things along the way. And so, having that conversation about porn of, this is very unrealistic. This isn't what sex and intimacy really looks like, nor is what the movie shows either, because the movie shows, they're at dinner and then they're in the elevator and then they're having orgasms and also not realistic. So none of it is showing what a real sexual relationship looks like. And so when that's the standard, which is what most people have, then there are so many people out there who feel, there's so many women who feel like they're broken. There are so many men who feel like they aren't able to please their partner or give them orgasms. A huge thing I hear all the time is like, I can never experience an orgasm during intercourse. Like, what's wrong with me? Like, less than 18% of women Less than 18% of women reliably have orgasms during intercourse. Less than 18%. So if you are part of that 72% that requires clitoral stimulation, then guess what? You're perfectly normal. There's nothing wrong there. And if you know that that gives you orgasms, if you know that gives you pleasure, then that's awesome. You know that about yourself. So embrace that. Don't be embarrassed by that. Work with that. And I think when you have those switches, those reframes, it makes a lot of people feel better. And that's honestly so much of what I do. But, you know, back into that porn conversation, you have to sit down and have those tough conversations with your kids, and especially as they get a little bit older. But the consent conversation is obviously incredibly, incredibly important, because not if, when they watch porn, they are seeing a lot of non-consensual examples and thinking that that is what is natural and normal, and it's not.
Yeah, and it can give you, I mean, for a long, long time, young women have been told or shown that they should have a particular body shape. And you're seeing it now with men as well. Most porn star men are quite muscular, have a big cock, and it stays hard forever in the filming, in the way we see the film. All women have no hair below their neckline, and they're all, multi. Oh my goodness, what's the word? Flexible, athletic, gymnast types, and they can do anything. And it's that isn't real life. And the one thing I was thinking is quite odd. So a lot of people, that worry about porn, worry about, oh my gosh, that'll lead people to want to explore kink and BDSM, whatever. Actually, if you talk to people in the kink and BDSM communities, they are the people that talk more about consent and negotiation and contracts even, and the yes, no, maybe, and the safe words and things. That's where it's actually discussed. And it's almost part of the erotic nature of BDSM, right? What can we do? What won't we do? What's a safe word? All those things. Whereas in vanilla sex, we just go at it without any questions about, yeah, do you like being choked? Do you like being spanked? Do you like your hair pulled or whatever? Whereas in BDSM and kink, we have that conversation beforehand, and we have a much closer dynamic in a way. And it's weird, because then people fear that element. Oh my goodness, imagine my child turns out wanting, is kinky, or wants to get into BDSM. Well, actually, they're going to bring a far more dialogue and far more understanding of what they like and don't like than if they were just sticking with the purely vanilla sex that they might see more often.
Yeah, I think that the way that kink is approached and BDSM is approached is honestly such a healthier way of approaching sex and intimacy. And I would love for the same process and conversations that occur and that are expected to occur when exploring, you know, different elements of kink and BDSM, if that was brought into, you know, quote unquote, vanilla sex.
Yeah.
You know, if we had those exact same conversations, then how much more pleasurable and productive and fun and connective would those sexual experiences be for that quote unquote vanilla couple that then might find out they're a little bit kinky. Absolutely. You never know. But and I think part of the necessity of that in the kink and BDSM community is a lot of times it's, you know, the partners aren't in a relationship, right? They're yeah, setting up a scene. We're going to be exploring this particular thing. We're doing this just for pleasure. We're doing this just yeah, because we both know we're going to enjoy it, even if we aren't in a relationship outside of that. And so those boundaries have to be made abundantly clear. But I think those boundaries need to be made abundantly clear in any relationship. So, and recognizing this is okay, this is not okay, this is how I'd like to be touched, this is what I want. And it also being able to verbalize that, you have to know. Yeah. You have to know that for yourself. You have to know what it is that you like, what it is that you don't like. And I think, again, so many people are just kind of doing without thinking. Again, following the model of porn or movies, yeah, or, you know, yeah, whatever, and not actually taking the time to recognize what it is they do truly like. And then once they discover it, then they're like, oh no, this is something that I'm, you know, like, I want to explore more. Mm-hmm. But in order to have that conversation, you have to know what that is.
I've taken a lot of time, and you did say we could talk all day, but I won't talk all day. Just a couple more if it's okay, and they're both more personal. So one is, obviously you talk to clients. I'm sure some clients represent with trauma and have been through some difficult situations, and they bring that to you, and you are there. You obviously want to be very present with them and want to be very much there for them. How do you almost protect and nourish your well-being so that you don't carry that trauma away with you once a session's finished?
Oh, that's a big question. And, you know, I think to do this work, you have to be a very empathetic person.
Yeah.
And I am, you know, I'm certainly an empath, and I definitely absorb and read emotions and energy and things like that. I spend a lot of time really thinking about my clients and how I can help them and what is it that they need, you know, between sessions and things like that. But they do share really big things, traumatic things in their lives. And I make a space for that. And I've learned to have a container, you know, that I can put things in. I visualize it. It's a locker. It has a lock. It looks a lot like my high school locker, actually. And when I come out of a session, and sometimes I need to take some time, but I have to put that away, and I have to put it in the container for a little bit, because I can't carry around everybody's trauma. And I think that the empathetic part of myself would and has in the past, that is something that I've done. And so, you know, I think there's different tools that can be used, but for me, sort of the container has been a good place where I can kind of put things away, and then I can pull it back out when, you know, it's time to prepare for a session, or if I know we're going to be talking about certain things. And then, you know, and then the other thing too, that, you know, I think is important, is I am not a therapist. I'm not a licensed therapist. I'm a coach, and I let my clients know this up front. And so if the root of whatever is going on is deeply rooted in trauma or something in the past, then I refer them to go see a therapist first, or sometimes concurrently. Sometimes we work together, but I'm not trained in supporting with trauma. I certainly recognize the effects that it can have on sex and intimacy, and we can talk through pieces of that. But if that is a major part of what's going on, then I will make sure that they're connected with the right therapist to help them process that.
And then my final question, and I'm not sure whether you are a very future looking person or not a planner, do you have a view as to what the next 5-10 years might look like? I guess start professionally, and then you can answer personally if you want to.
My dream, and I am getting the right people in the room to make it happen, is going back to my cancer experience when I had the oncologist, the psychologist, the radiologist, the breast surgeon, all of those same people in the room, and they'd all spend that time talking about me. I want that for sexual health and wellness. I want a sexual wellness center where there is a therapist and a sex coach and a somatic sexologist and yoga classes and breathing classes and intimacy toys and everything all in one place, so that when a person or a couple walks in and they say, this is what we're experiencing, a pelvic floor therapist, all of those people are in the room, and they can look at all of the different pieces of it and say, this is our plan for you. You aren't alone. We can help you. And we know exactly how to do it. And I don't understand why this doesn't really exist yet. Like, this doesn't seem like it should be that revolutionary, but, and I've seen a few models that are kind of approaching that, but I haven't seen anything quite like I'm envisioning. So that is that's my dream. I would love to be able to make that happen in 5 years. And again, I have been having some really fantastic conversations and meeting some really wonderful professionals. And, you know, getting it off the ground is obviously the challenging part. Mm-hmm. You know, 10 years, I mean, all I've ever wanted to do in my, I love traveling. Like it honestly is a little comical to me that like I live in the suburbs, I drive a minivan. I live this very ordinary life by my definition, wonderful life. I'm not complaining about it and I'm very blessed to have it, but I love traveling the world and I've been to many places, but all I've ever wanted to do is live in another country. I lived briefly in England. Mm-hmm. I lived briefly in Spain, but I wasn't able to stay long-term because I was a young woman. I was 19 and ultimately I just didn't feel safe. That's what I realized was I wasn't comfortable exploring the way that I wanted to explore because I wasn't comfortable exploring on my own. And I think that was probably pretty smart on my part. But I, when these children are gone, I've told James, and I've been laying this groundwork for a long time. I was like, we are moving somewhere. I don't even know that I care where. No, that's not true. I do care, but I just want to go live in another country. And whether it ends up being for a year or 5 years or the rest of our lives, I don't really know. But I love experiencing new cultures and I love just seeing how vast and wide this world is. And I love learning new languages and I just want to immerse myself in all of that. So that is my longer term plan. I don't know how I can run the sexual wellness center and travel the world. I'm not sure. I haven't reconciled those two yet, but you know, I don't have to have all of the pieces planned out just yet.
It's interesting. That's a wonderful answer. Wonderful. And I've for a long time now, without ever having been there, have an overwhelming desire and knowledge that one day I'll live in Costa Rica.
Oh, yeah. Costa Rica's top of my list. Yes,
but and there's somebody that I know, a lady called Jessie Magic, and she's setting up a sexual wellness retreat center in Costa Rica. So anyway, I mean, if people are going to go to almost if they see it more as a retreat and bring everything together, then people want to go to beautiful, incredible places. So one of my friends, she left her corporate job as a lawyer in Victoria, and she's moved up to North Queensland to set up a yoga retreat. She does yoga retreat and she does pole dancing lessons. So quite random. But yeah, so I think no matter wherever you are is where the place is. So think about what country it's in. But yeah, wherever you are is where it is. I look forward to hearing more about that when it's thank you so much for your for giving me more than I asked for. You're very, very generous with your knowledge, your time, and yeah, you and James just sound like you've got it sorted.
Thank you so much for this opportunity, Andrew. It's been wonderful to speak with you and I appreciate you just giving me the opportunity to share. So thank you for the invitation. And to everyone who's listening to this wonderful podcast, I also just want to commend you for being willing to learn and expand your mind and take this time in investing in yourself and your sex life, because it's such an important part. And, you know, just the fact that you're here listening to all of these wonderful podcasts that Andrew has done for you speaks loudly about what it is that you want and expect in your life.
Well, thank you.